We are going to talk about depression, neurobiological, what the neurobiology of depression is, what's underlying and driving it, and then drug-free interventions to help us treat depression. If you would like a lot of scientific articles, this is my latest book, The Aging Brain, Proven Steps to Prevent Dementia and Sharpen Your Mind. And much of the science that I'm going to go over that helps prevent depression also helps prevent dementia. So that book has got about 400 references in it. It's very, if you're looking for a source with that. So what is major depression when we talk about major depression? We are not talking about simply a sad mood that comes because of a disappointment. We're talking about a clinical condition. And this clinical condition is a complex brain-body disease in which we have changes in brain circuitry, both functionally and structurally. And I will go through that and show you that. This causes neuroendocrine changes and immune system changes, and I will show you that connection. And that reacts back upon the brain, damaging brain cells and altering gene expression in the brain, which alters various important proteins for our brain, contributing to depression. Now, I'll walk you through that as well. Now, what makes us vulnerable to this are our genetics, what we've inherited from our parents, and then our environment causing changes in how the genes respond. Some years ago, everybody heard of serotonin? Know what serotonin is? It's a neurotransmitter, one of the chemicals the brain uses. Some years ago, they discovered the gene that codes for the transporter that transports this. And so in the brain, when one neuron wants to talk to another neuron, it releases a neurotransmitter in a little space between the neurons called a synapse. And the neuron that releases it has little vacuum cleaners, like little pumps, like vacuum cleaners, will suck it back in and repackage it to use again. So release, suck back in, reuptake pumps is what they're called. And on the serotonin neurons, they discovered the gene that codes for the reuptake pumps that takes serotonin back in. And they discovered in the human genome there is a polymorphism, meaning there's more than one version of this gene. And there's a short arm version and a long arm version, and that's what's represented there. And when they first, because you get one set from mom and one set from dad, you can have two short arms, a short and long, or two long arm versions. And when they first discovered this, they discovered people with the short arm versions have a much higher rate of depression than people with long arm version. And so they said, oh, we found a gene that codes for depression. But then they studied a little more and they discovered that the short arm version actually does not code for depression. It codes for sensitivity to the environment. So if you have the short arm version and in your childhood you have a traumatic, stressful, abusive childhood, then you have higher rates of depression than people who have traumatic childhoods with the long arm version. But if you have the short arm version and you have a loving, nurturing, healthy environment, you actually have less depression than people with the long arm version, and you're more likely to be a leader in society. You're just more sensitive to what the environment is doing to you. So it's not just the genes we get, it's how the genes are interacting with environment that contributes to the cascade of events that leads to depression. And that's what this slide shows. The blue column shows people had no childhood trauma issues. The green, probable, the red, severe childhood trauma stuff. And then on the left grouping, these are people with two long arm versions of the serotonin gene. The middle are the long and short, and on the right are two short arm versions. And so you notice the red column here. If you had severe childhood abuse and you have two short arm versions, you have much more depression than people with two long arm versions. But if you had no childhood abuse and you have two long arm versions, you have a less depression than people who are traumatized, but you have more depression than the short arm people who had a healthy childhood. So again, it's not just the genes that we get, it's how those genes are interacting with the environment. It's a very interesting study that revealed this. So I went through the brain circuits this morning in detail, and I'm not going to run through the whole scenario with you, just going to recap that very quickly. But remember the alarm. When the alarm fires, it activates our emergency operator, which sends for emergency responders out of our adrenal glands, adrenaline and glucocorticoids, and those will register to our fire chief in the hippocampus, which will send an inhibitory signal back to limit the call for more. And then we have an administrator who is designed to calm this whole network down. When people are in depression, these circuits are out of balance. When somebody's depressed, their thinking circuit, dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, where you organize, plan, strategize, problem solve, pay attention, focus, that part of the brain is underactive. So people in depression have a much more difficult time handling life stressors, problem solving, making decisions. They're often ambivalent, don't know what to do. The anterior cingulate cortex, the seat of the will, where you make choices and where you experience empathy, other-centered love, is also underactive. So people in depression will have difficult time making decisions and will often feel emotionally isolated or disconnected from people. They don't feel that same loving support because this part of the brain is underactive. The orbital and ventral medial cortexes, where you get a conviction when you're doing something wrong, a conviction of wrongdoing, feeling of guilt, is overactive. So people in depression will often feel inadequate or guilty or not good enough. The amygdala, our fear circuit, is also overactive. So they get a sense of worry and dread and apprehension. And the nucleus accumbens, which is the seat of pleasure. So anything you experience pleasure in is activating the nucleus accumbens, is basically unresponsive in depression. So a person with depression will have difficult time focusing and concentrating, feel isolated and alone, have difficult time in decision-making, feel guilty and inadequate, feel apprehensive and worried. And then if something good happens in their life, they still get no joy. This is how the circuits are operating when someone's in the state of depression. So anything that imbalances our brain circuits in this way, upregulates amygdala, downregulates prefrontal cortex, impairs functioning of anterior cingulate cortex. Anything that moves the circuits this way pushes people towards depression. Intrauterine environment. So how about a child? How about a mother? And while she's pregnant, she's highly stressed. It may not be her fault. It might be that she's just a worried, anxious person, but it could be a very healthy young woman whose husband gets deployed in a military conflict. She's going to be stressed during that pregnancy. Or her own mother gets diagnosed with aggressive cancer during her pregnancy. Or her husband's killed in a car wreck during her pregnancy. So it may not be that she has bad thinking patterns. She just is hit with some really hard stressors during pregnancy. If that happens, she's going to have elevated stress hormones called glucocorticoids. They cross the placental barrier. They cross the developing blood-brain barrier. And they alter epigenetically, altering gene expression on the developing brain's ability to calm itself. So these children are born with, these children are born with upregulated anxiety centers, and they're less capable of calming themselves as a starting point at birth than they would have been had mother not been highly stressed in pregnancy. And so this is a starting point that makes them more vulnerable to depression later in life. The brain remains highly pliable and changeable. So depending on what happens next in life, early childhood experiences are going to continue to develop and alter the brain depending on what the child goes through. How about a mother's thinking while pregnant? Well, a study of over 4,000 mothers and their children followed for 18 years found that mothers with negative, pessimistic, depressogenic thinking patterns increased the risk of their child having depression 18 years later. And after accounting for other associations and potential contributing factors, they believed that the thought patterns alone increased the risk 21%. And this makes sense to me because negative, depressogenic, anxious thinking patterns activate the stress circuitry, which kicks up glucocorticoids. And the glucocorticoids change brain development in a developing brain. So we talk about intrauterine environment. What about stressful early childhood environment and nurturing? 25-year study funded by the National Institute of Mental Health found that family conflict and violence appeared to be more important in affecting youth outcome than marital status, meaning that children do better in divorced homes where there's peace and stability and love than in homes with two parents where there's constant conflict and fighting going on. So the healthiest home for kids, I will tell you, this is unequivocal, is a two-parent home where the parents have maturity, they have healthy love, there's low conflict, there's good structure. This is the absolute healthiest environment for home, for kids. But the next healthy environment is a single-parent home where there's love, good structure, low conflict. They do better in that home than a two-parent home in which there is perpetual argument. We're not talking the kids being directly abused. We're talking the parents who are always fighting, always at odds, always arguing. So the home is not a place of peace. It's a place of stress. The kids don't do as well. And the worst home is a single-parent home in which there's always argument, conflict, hostility. It's not a safe place. Kids need to have a sanctuary, a home where it's safe, where they're not always on edge. And it impacts brain development. So I talked about the salience network this morning. And sensory information comes in, and it passes through the thalamus on its way to its cortical destination. If it's a potential threat to you, it will be tagged. And then it's sent to your prefrontal cortex for you to make a plan to deal with it. If this network becomes disrupted, we get negative ruminating loops going that keep the amygdala activated or turned on. And what disrupts the salience network, again, is denial, refusing truth, believing lies, exploiting others, acting selfishly, and refusing to repent. And that leads to more lies because people who don't repent rationalize or distort or make lies to make themselves feel okay so that they can avoid the guilt. And a grudge holding or resentment, all of this keeps the person in greater stress, which activates the amygdala, which causes the more stress cascades. So I went through what does the amygdala doesn't calm. I'm going to expand on this a little bit now. This is a critical concept to understand. If the amygdala doesn't calm, it turns on your immune system. And I said this morning, because your immune system is to your body what your National Guard is to your nation. Now I want to expand on this. You have two types of immunity. You have your acquired immunity, which is what we exploit with a vaccine. You give somebody a vaccine, polio vaccine, you're giving them dead polio virus, dead enemy invader. As they come into your body, your immune system sees and says, look at all those enemies from the land of polio. Because even though they come in dead, they come in carrying the flag of their nation. And we call that an antigen. And your immune system sees it. And it goes, look at all those invaders from the land of polio. Let's train up some soldiers to kill those guys. And so they send off some people to basic training. And they come back, special operators, as snipers, to watch for anything with the flag from polio. And they'll snipe and kill them. We call those antibodies. And if you've been vaccinated or have recovered from an illness, your immune system has identified the flag or the antigens of those particular invading organisms, and you have created these snipers that will sit and monitor your body, and if they see anything carrying that flag, they'll attack it and kill it. But they leave all the other invaders alone. So you should conceptualize the acquired immunity as a sniper, and a sniper has one bullet, watches for one invader, and gets them very precisely. This is not what's happening. The example of the being on the trail and being confronted with a black bear this morning. Well, you're on the trail with a black bear. You have no idea what the invaders are going to be, and if you do get bitten or clawed, you don't have time to train any snipers up. You don't have time for your immune system to create antibodies. So we have another type of immunity, and that's our macrophages. And you should conceptualize the macrophages as a home invasion, and you've got a sawed-off shotgun under the bed. Anybody know what a shotgun is? Anybody not know what a shotgun is? Okay? The difference is a shotgun has a shell with 50 BBs in it. And as you blast, you get a wide scatter shot. Instead of a single bullet, you get a wide scatter shot. So you hear the invader, you point, you blast, wide scatter shot. You just got the invader, but what else just got damaged? Your house just got damaged. And in our metaphor, the house is your body. And so these inflammatory cytokines, these are analogous to the BBs. These will kill the enemy invaders coming in. But you don't have any enemy invaders. You're under chronic, worried, anxious stress. So you're just walking around your house with a shotgun blowing holes in your house. Metaphorically speaking. And so these damage, I mentioned this morning, insulin receptors, we get insulin resistance in the face of increasing glucocorticoids. This leads to the, as I said earlier, increasing diabetes mellitus type 2, adult onset diabetes, obesity, high cholesterol, heart attack, strokes, all those things are true. I didn't mention this morning, I'll tell you now, these inflammatory cytokines also interfere with normal neuron-to-neuron communications, what's called synaptic signaling. And if I were to take a syringe, and that stands for norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine, part of the neurotransmitters that we use in our brain, and they interfere with this normal signaling. And if I were to take a syringe and inject you with just one syringe full of these inflammatory cytokines, within a few hours, you will start feeling aches and pains all over your body. You'll get extreme malaise and fatigue. You'll have foggy focus, concentration. You'll have sleep disturbance, nausea, loss of appetite. And for any of you, any clinicians in the room? So what I just described are the neurovegetative symptoms of depression. That's what they are, because depression is a highly inflamed state. Now I'm showing you a synapse. On the left is an actual micrograph. On the right is a picturization of the synapse. And most of the time when you see, and I've got another picture later, you'll see the standard view of a synapse. You simply see a presynaptic neuron and a postsynaptic neuron. That's how they're mostly depicted. But that's not how synapses exist in the brain. There's always three parts to a synapse, and most of the time the pictures leave out the third part. This one does not. We do have a presynaptic neuron, and those little circles you see, those are vesicles. And inside those vesicles, depending on what neuron this is, it would have dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, or GABA, or glutamate, or one of the neurotransmitters. And that would have been produced up here in the cell body and then transported down and stored here, waiting for a signal to bind to the membrane and release that into that little dark space, which is the synapse. And there are little pumps there that will then suck that back in and repackage again. This is your postsynaptic neuron, which has receptors that will react when it's triggered by those chemicals. And then this green is an astrocyte, and that's what we're going to talk about now. If you want to know and remember what an astrocyte does, think astronaut. Because an astronaut never goes out into space without their spacesuit. And what does their spacesuit do for the astronaut? What's its function? It provides a milieu, an environment to keep the astronaut healthy. That's what the astrocyte does. The astrocyte buffers calcium and potassium and makes various proteins that keep the neuron healthy. And that's its job. It just provides a nice milieu that the neurons like. Now, with that in mind, this shows the circulation. This is your blood circulating. Blood circulation. And you're highly stressed. You've been anxious. You've sent a signal from your brain to your adrenal glands. You've kicked up the corticosteroids. You've got your immune system turned on. And those inflammatory cytokines are circulating here in your bloodstream. And there's another brain cell called a microglia. It's a white cell. It monitors your bloodstream. And normally, microglia will turn an amino acid called tryptophan. Anybody heard of tryptophan? It's a precursor. It's the precursor amino acid your brain uses to make serotonin. And normally, tryptophan, TRP, tryptophan, is turned into serotonin by microglia. But when we become inflamed, The white cells register that, and an epigenetic change happens, meaning inside the neurons you have these little factories, and these little factories take products and they make end products, and they take tryptophan and they turn that tryptophan into serotonin. There's a little factory assembly line doing that. That's your genes. Your genes that are turned on are activating and creating this production process. But now that we're highly inflamed, what's happened is a signal's come in and said, shut that factory line down. And that factory line gets shut down. And now tryptophan gets sent down a new gene that's turned on. And now instead of making serotonin, we're making quinolinic acid from tryptophan in a highly inflamed state. And quinolinic acid is toxic to astroglia. It damages the astroglia. You're out in space. Tiny little micrometeors start blasting through your spacesuit and you start venting atmosphere. You are not a happy astronaut. Okay, this is not good. And so when our astroglia begin to get damaged, they stop buffering calcium and glutamate properly. This stuff starts flowing inside the neurons. We begin to lose neurons. We actually have another epigenetic change, and that stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Brain-derived means the brain makes it. Neurotrophic means it makes neurons strong. So think of it as fertilizer for your neurons. It's a protein that actually causes the neurons to branch new connections and make new synaptic plasticity happen more rapidly. You can learn better. It prevents a loss of neurons. It just is good for our neurons. In fact, every antidepressant treatment that is thus far shown, whether it's medicine, whether it's cognitive therapy, whether it's shock therapy, whether it's magnetic therapy, every treatment that has antidepressant benefit turns BDNF back on. That's what it does. And what's happening in this inflamed state, when we damage our white cells, they lose their trophic support. Epigenetic changes happen in the neurons, and we stop producing brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And hippocampal regions begin to wither. Our prefrontal cortex begins to thin. We're getting structural changes now in our brain circuits. So changes in the brain when someone is depressed, we have inflammatory factors damaging our white cells. The white cells stop providing the support. Instead, we get more oxidative stress on the brain. We lose the production, the production of new neurons. We have altered the DNA expression, as I've mentioned. We've lost neurotrophic factors. We have impaired prefrontal cortex functioning and then the structural changes in the prefrontal cortex and hippocampus. This is a PET scan looking at activity of a depressed brain on the left and a non-depressed brain on the right. The left brain has not had a stroke. There's not neuronal death going on here. This is significant reduction in neural firing and neural activity going on here. And this is what a depressed brain looks like. So why do imbalance brain circuits? So I told you, anything that imbalances the brain circuits pushes people towards depression. Why? Why do the imbalanced brain circuits lead to depression? Because the imbalanced brain circuits increase inflammation, turns on the immune system, kicking up the inflammatory factors, and the inflammatory factors are what are causing those cellular changes in the brain that we just went through in the last couple slides. So if the inflammatory factors are doing it, are you thinking, well, what happens if we just increase inflammation without having the brain circuits change first? Exactly. So anything that increases inflammation increases the risk of depression. And study of 9,000 adults examining the amount of junk food they eat, pizzas, croissants, hamburgers, donuts, candies, cakes, found that, in fact, those who ate junk food had a 40% higher rate of depression than those who didn't eat junk food. See, junk food is highly inflammatory food. Fried foods, highly inflammatory. Have you heard of advanced glycation end products? Those are molecules in which a glucose molecule has bound to some other molecule, and that becomes a glycated molecule because there's a glucose molecule bound to it. And that new molecule can't function, and it causes significant damage to the body's end organs. Has anybody heard of hemoglobin A1C? Hemoglobin A1C is what they measure in diabetics to see how well their glucose is being controlled. And it's highly inflammatory. Hemoglobin A1C damages end organs. That's why diabetics have retinal damage and renal damage and peripheral neuropathies, because it's a highly oxidizing or inflammatory damaging state. Well, when you fry foods or sear foods at high temperature, the cooking method forms advanced glycation end products. And you absorb a portion of that into your body when you eat it. So highly processed foods with certain cooking methods are highly inflammatory to us and accelerate aging and increase our risk of depression. Any amount of this type will increase your risk, but it is a dose dependent. The more of the junk stuff you eat, the greater the risk. What about smoking? Highly inflammatory. It increases risk of depression. Alcohol abuse increases risk of depression. Drug abuse increases risk of depression. All these things, highly oxidizing, inflammatory. And then if you have the adult onset diabetes, this is an inflammatory state in its own right, and it increases your risk of depression 24% because of the advanced glycation products like hemoglobin A1C. Chronic pain increases your risk of depression. For a variety of reasons, the chronic pain, when you get a pain signal, it is a stress signal. Your body reacts to that as a potential threat, so your amygdala upregulates, and you are more stressed from that. And people with chronic pain also have significant sleep disturbance, and sleep disturbance contributes to these problems. So with all this in mind, let me ask you guys a question. If someone has depression, does that mean depression is sin, they are in sin, or they just don't have enough faith? Only one person knew that answer. I heard one no. Oh, it's one, two, because somebody shook their head too. No, I put this up for you. Some of you may chuckle, but this is actually fairly common in certain Christian circles And I've heard pastors in public forums and on television networks talk about the idea that if you have faith, you won't have depression. But that would be like saying, if you have faith, you won't need eyeglasses. Now, is it true that God is a God of miracles and God has the ability to heal anybody's eyes in such a way that they have perfect vision and don't need glasses? Could God do that? Does that mean if you ask for it and you don't get it, you don't have enough faith? But why didn't he do it? See, this is how some of this thinking goes when it comes to depression. And I have many people that are worse because their churches tell them that if they just had more faith, God would heal them from their depression. Now, he could. He certainly could. He's got that ability. But we should not conclude that simply because somebody has depression, that their problem is a lack of faith. I think that's a significant distortion and actually adds burden and false guilt to people. So interventions, we talk about now, because this is, we're going to talk about the interventions. How do we help somebody with depression? Because their talk is neurobiology of depression, drug-free treatment. So I've gone through the neurobiology now. You see the cascade of events that are driving. What can we do to intervene? What is the number one treatment for depression? At least in America, probably in Norway as well. What do you think the number one treatment for depression is? That's the number one thing your doctors prescribe in Norway? So when you go to a doctor in Norway and say, and you've got diagnosed with depression, they send you out on an exercise routine? That's the number one thing they do? Oh, okay, antidepressants, right? That's the number one treatment. How effective do you think they are? If we have 100 people with their first episode of depression, never having failed treatment, and we put that, and anybody that's failed treatment with an antidepressant, we can't let them in our study. So we're protecting our study from any people that have a history of unresponsiveness. And so we take this good potentially responsive people, and we put them in, and we give them a serotonin reuptake inhibitor like citalopram. What percentage do you think we get well? You guys are really good. 28%, which means 72% don't get well. And if we take that group that didn't get well and we treat them with a second, that second group, 21% of those get well. And if they failed two, the third group, 16% get well. And if they failed three, in this particular study, 7% get well. So antidepressants for some individuals are life-saving, transformational, and absolutely that's all some individuals actually ever need. They get that depression, antidepressant, and they're just really good. But for the mass of people that have depression, antidepressants alone are often not sufficient. And that's because they have many other variables other than just a neurochemical tweak that they need. And then in that same study, it showed that the first group, about 8.5% dropped out because of side effects, 23% in the third, 35%, and then by the fourth group, 41%. So it gets more side effects and intolerances and less effective the more medicine trials people tend to go through. We're filtering our population, becoming more and more treatment resistant group. So medications circulate throughout the body. They affect multiple systems and organs, and they can impact fetuses. One study showed that serotonin alters language development. If a woman is pregnant and has an SSRI during pregnancy, that they can have some delayed language development in their child. Paxil or paroxetine can cause cardiac defects. But interestingly enough, they looked at this quite aggressively. There's no association at all with autism in using antidepressant medicines. There's no relationship. So you look at this and you go, oh, okay, we shouldn't have a pregnant woman on an antidepressant. That, if you're thinking that, remember what I told you earlier about if the woman's highly stressed during pregnancy, it alters the braking mechanism in her child's developing brain, and that child will be born with an amygdala upregulated, more anxious, and more prone to anxiety disorders and depression later in life. Depression is a highly inflamed and anxious state. So not treating her will also cause negative brain changes. So it's not simple either or. Further, if a mother has postpartum depression, multiple research has shown that children do very poorly in a postpartum state when the mother is depressed, and that alters the brain development further, causing more social and anxiety and depression problems later in life because the early childhood contact with the mother, the caressing, the holding, the hugging, the cooing, and all these things that go on alter the developing brain, which upregulates the braking mechanism and calms the fear circuitry. If children don't get that because the mother's depressed and doesn't have the energy to put in, then that further worsens brain development. So you have to weigh these things out and say, so should we? Maybe there could be a little bit of a relationship to a little delayed language. but the mother won't be depressed and she'll be highly involved and highly active and highly loving, which is better? Well, that's a conversation you have with the pregnant woman. And they have to make that decision. Some of them are secreted in breast milk, some are not. You have to look and see which ones are. This is simply that single synapse without the glia there, simply to show you how they work. And they release the neurotransmitter, the neuron fires. Neurotransmitters release. These are postsynaptic receptors. And then over here would be reuptake pumps that get shut down by the antidepressant. And by shutting them down, you increase postsynaptic signaling. So you get a stronger signal because you have more transmitter out here signaling longer because we're not sucking it back away. Okay? And then what happens when we signal here, that's the norepinephrine or serotonin signaling the receptor in the postsynaptic neuron, then a cascade of second messengers happen. And as these cascade of second messengers happen, they go all the way down to the DNA and they turn on brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And as we turn on brain-derived neurotrophic factor, we get more synaptogenesis, meaning new synapses are formed, new neurons and neural pathways are formed, we get better cell survival, new neurons. So that's what's happening. This is how antidepressants work, and this is why it often will take a couple of weeks after you start an antidepressant to see the benefit, because these second messengers have to go down and actually alter how the DNA is expressed, and new proteins have to be produced, and those proteins have to get outside the neuron and start doing their work. Anybody here treat anybody with depression? Have you ever seen somebody that you treated, you started the antidepressant, several weeks later they really got better, several months later they're really well? And then they stop their antidepressant and they relapse. Have you ever seen it? You've seen it, yes. So what happens epigenetically down here where the DNA is that in the DNA region where BDNF is, a methyl group will attach to the DNA and it will lock down that gene. Conceptualize that as a shirt tail caught in your zipper. You get a shirt tail caught in your zipper, DNA is like a zipper, a double helix. It can't unzip, it can't be expressed. What happens when you give an antidepressant, these second messengers cause an acetyl group to attach right next to the methyl group, and the acetyl group neutralizes the methyl group, and so the DNA now unzips, and we start producing BDNF again. That's how the antidepressants work. If you remember your organic chemistry, I know everybody does, acetyl groups have weaker chemical bonds than methyl groups. So they're well on their antidepressant, and then they stop their antidepressant, and over the course of weeks and months, the acetyl groups start breaking off the DNA, but the methyl group is still attached, so the DNA locks down here again, stop producing BDNF, and people relapse back into depression. This is one of the reasons why the more episodes of depression a person has, the more vulnerable they are to relapse, because in a single episode of depression, not all billions of neurons will have the DNA in those neurons methylated. But with every episode of depression, more and more of the brain's DNA becomes methylated, and therefore it's easier for them to relapse back into depression. So, non-drug interventions. First thing you have to do is you have to think, what are the contributing factors? Okay, somebody's coming to my office, and I see that this person has clinical depression. I diagnose them with depression. One of the bad things about the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual for Psychiatric Diagnoses, is that it's a checklist. You can check off the diagnosing criteria and say, oh, I've got the diagnosis, and then people go, diagnosed depression? Okay, antidepressant. And that's as far as it goes. They never think. Once you diagnose depression, you still don't know what is wrong with that person. You know, that's how they present with depression, but you don't have to answer this question, why? Why is this person depressed? Is this person depressed because they have severe hypothyroidism? They have a sleep disorder that's not treated. They're in a marriage where they're getting beaten regularly. They're abusing alcohol. Is this person depressed because they have trauma issues they never worked through? Or they're in a marriage conflict? I mean, you have to identify the contributing factors. They just have a really bad diet and they have just high inflamed state in their body. What's going on? Until you identify the factors, you really don't know how to intervene. So think, what are the factors? And then some of the things you can do, psychotherapy. What does psychotherapy do? Remember, the neural circuits are out of balance. Psychotherapy activates dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, gets people thinking. That then, as it activates, will calm amygdala. Remember the study we already talked about this morning? That's why the psychotherapy works, because the psychotherapy turns on dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, exercising it, and the normal job of prefrontal cortex and anterior cingulate cortex is to send a calming signal down to the amygdala, and that's what this data shows. Psychotherapy without medicine resulted in antidepressant benefit and normalized brain circuitry function, moving the circuits back towards their non-depressed state. Socialization and social connections. Loneliness and gene expression. Gene expression in white blood cells of 6 lonely people were compared to 8 socially connected people. 209 gene differences were identified. And genes associated with inflammation were turned on in the socially isolated or lonely group, where they were turned down in the socially connected group. So lonely people may be at greater risk for depression because of the higher inflamed state than the socially connected group. These findings were confirmed in a separate study of 93 individuals. So this is a pilot study, and then it was repeated in a larger group and found the same thing. So social connectivity. Well, guess what? They've found that is most protective for children growing up. National Institute of Health. The two variables that are most protective to kids' mental health and well-being, first is family member confidant. Having somebody in their family that they can actually confide in and talk to. They feel safe opening up to and sharing their secrets with. Coming home and saying they're being bullied at school. They're being laughed at school. Do you know how many kids don't have anybody at home that they can feel safe talking to? They're embarrassed or ashamed. But having someone at home they can talk to is protective to kids. And then the other is family cohesion. Family cohesion is that sense that our family sticks together. We have each other's back. We don't embarrass our family members. We don't air dirty laundry out in public. If somebody's picking on somebody in our family, we stand up for them. That sense of cohesion and unity, we stick together. We've got your back. Both of those things neurobiologically calm down amygdala. Not having those things make a person feel more vulnerable, more exposed, more insecure, which upregulate amygdala. Meaning the person grows up with higher inflamed state because they're anxious and worried and stressed. They're vigilant. They got to watch out. They got to watch their back because they have nobody that they can trust, nobody they can confide in, nobody that's got their back. So they're on edge all the time. That's the difference. So family environment, social connections that are healthy are quite protective to the neurobiology. Somatic means physical, what we can do with our bodies. We can exercise. And a study shows that when we exercise regularly, our muscles produce something called interleukin-10. That's a powerful anti-inflammatory cytokine. Remember from stress, all those other cytokines that go up? Exercise reduces them because the muscles produce interleukin-10. So if you've heard of a condition called fibromyalgia, the number one treatment for reducing pain in fibromyalgia is exercise, if you can get them to do it. Because it's an inflamed state with a lot of inflammatory cytokines that cause aches and pains all over the body. Exercise will reduce that and reduce their sense of pain. It also increases insulin sensitivity, meaning reduces insulin resistance. Turns on all neurotrophins. BDNF is one neurotrophin, one protein that acts like a fertilizer in the brain. But there are others, vascular growth factor, nerve growth factor. Exercise is the only intervention that has been shown to turn them all on. All the antidepressant treatments only turn on BDNF. Exercise turns them all on. Also, it turns on increases endorphins and enkephalins, which are mood elevators. Gives you that runner's high, if you've ever had a runner's high. That's the endorphins and enkephalins. And an American Journal of Psychiatry article 2017, over 33,000 people followed for 11 years, found that notice this rigorous exercise here. 1 hour of leisure exercise per week. Okay. Just think that through. I mean, I don't even know if I can call that exercise. But that leisure exercise, 1 hour a week, reduced depression by 12%. Significant from the control group that didn't exercise. Lifestyle changes, nutrition, L-methylfolate. This is the methylated version of folic acid. Folic acid in food, oranges, green leafy vegetables, cannot get into your brain. It has to go through a two-step metabolic process where your body will metabolize it and add a methyl group, L-methylfolate. And then the transporter will transport the methylated folate into your brain. Now get this, guys, where it is a required cofactor for your brain to make dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin. 50 to 60% of people with depression have a genetic mutation where their bodies cannot metabolize folic acid into the form the brain needs. It's called the MTHFR gene defect, MTHFR gene. And therefore, their brain cannot produce normal amounts of serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine. Treating them with L-methylfolate has the same antidepressant benefit as antidepressants. Now, this is in America, you do a cheek swab and you get a gene test to see if they have it. People without the gene defect, guess what? It's methylated folate. Your body can use it too. So no harm in giving it to people without the gene defect, but it helps all the people with the gene defect. And it also helps people without it because it raises your L-methylfolate levels, which also have an anti-inflammatory benefit in addition to the cofactor to produce the neurotransmitters. Omega-3 fatty acids, these are long-chain DHA, EPA, 70% of the fat in your brain is long-chain omega-3s that your body cannot make. You must get it in food. And if you don't have it, then it increases your risk of depression. In fact, this is one of the major factors in postpartum depression because during fetal development, there is a parasite sucking away nutrition from the mother. That was a joke. Nobody laughed. But there is this fetus, and it's true, sucking nutrition away from the mother, and particularly omega-3s from her brain. And if she gets omega-3 deficient, she is more vulnerable to postpartum depression. This is one of the reasons they supplement the prenatal vitamins now with omega-3 fatty acids. If you get omegas from plant sources other than seaweed, certain sea algae will have the DHA and EPA in them. But the stuff like flaxseed and chia seeds, they have short-chain ALA, and the brain can't use short-chain ALA. Your body can convert about 7% into EPA and about 1% into DHA. The long chain, and 70% is of your brain fatty acid membranes are made up of DHA omega-3s. Let's move on from that. Junk food, so avoid eating a junk food diet. 41 studies, 20 of them longitudinal, meaning they followed people over time, evaluated various diets, and the Mediterranean diet, these are the different diets they evaluated, and what they found involving 36,000 people was that if you adhered to a Mediterranean diet, you had a 33% reduction in depression than if you didn't. Because the Mediterranean diet, which is a very plant-based diet with fish, high in omega-3 fatty acids. The other end of the spectrum, eating a pro-inflammatory diet, high in fat, sugar, processed foods, was linked to higher rates of depression, according to data from 5 longitudinal studies with over 32,000 people. So anything that increases, and you understand, anything that increases inflammation drives depression. So a diet that's anti-inflammatory, and the whole food vegan diets have also been shown to be anti-inflammatory, reduce your risk of dementia and depression. So the two diets associated with anti-depression and anti-dementia are the Mediterranean and the whole food vegan diet. Sleep. I probably should spend a few minutes on sleep. First, I'll just tell you, sleep apnea. This is the condition where your soft tissues cover your windpipe. While you're asleep, your diaphragm tries to pull air, but your windpipe is covered, so you can't. So your oxygen levels fall in your blood. Your brainstem is alerted that you're suffocating, so you wake up just enough to tighten the musculature in the back of your throat. You get oxygen in, and you go back into sleep, and you're in and out of stage one sleep all night. You don't get the deep restorative sleep. And this increases your risk of depression. It's associated with gray matter volume loss. The good news is when you treat it, both of the depression and the gray matter volume loss reverses. So you just need to get that treated. That's another example of why antidepressants don't work for everyone. Because somebody has depression, they get on antidepressant, but they're not sleeping and they're not oxygenating their brain. They're not going to get well on antidepressant. You've got to treat that. Sleep disorders double the risk of depression. Yes, your brain is 2 to 3% of your body weight, but it uses 20% of your body's energy. It's highly metabolic, lots of byproducts of metabolism. During sleep, your brain cells actually contract and will expel out of the inside of the cytoplasm of the neurons into the cerebrospinal fluid the waste products to be cleared out of your brain. If you are chronically sleep deprived, instead of jet lagged like I am, but if you're chronically sleep deprived, then you don't give your brain time to clear these byproducts of metabolism. It increases oxidative stress, increases both your risk of depression and your risk of dementia as you age. So 7 to 8 hours of sleep for an adult is essential to maintain brain health. Now, many people don't understand what normal sleep is. Many people think this is normal sleep. I fall asleep at a certain time, and I wake up 7 to 8 hours later. That's what they think. There's not one human brain on earth that sleeps like that. That's not how sleep works. If you go to a sleep lab, they'll put an EEG monitor where they can monitor your brain waves, and this is what normal sleep looks like. You fall first into a light stage of sleep. This is that light sleep when on Sabbath afternoon, grandma's snoring over there on the couch. Grandma, you're snoring. I wasn't even asleep yet. Okay? It's a light sleep where you don't even think you're sleeping. That's followed by stage 2 sleep, which then goes into stage 3, which is your slow wave sleep, where your brain waves slow down, your heart rate slows down, your blood pressure falls, your body temperature falls. This is the restorative sleep where you're repairing muscle damage if you've been working out or working in the yard. And then that's followed by REM, rapid eye movement sleep, where you do your dreaming. And then you wake up. And then stage 1, 2, deep sleep, REM, wake up. Stage 1, 2, deep sleep, REM, wake up all night long. From the time you enter stage 1 until the time you wake up at the end of REM is anywhere from 70 minutes to 120 minutes. When we're young or extremely physically exhausted, those wake-ups are just a few seconds where we shift and turn in the bed, and then we're right back into stage 1, and we have amnesia for the wake-up. We didn't know we woke up. We forget it. When we get older, wake up, bladder, and off to the bathroom we go. And now the next day, we remember waking up, and we go, I'm not sleeping good. I'm not sleeping good. And people begin to worry because I'm waking up 2 and 3 times a night. I'm not sleeping through the night. I need to get medication. And then they go to either get over-the-counter medication or prescriptions. And the classic medications prescribed for sleep, most of them, increase your risk of dementia. They interfere with normal sleep architectures. You no longer get the restorative sleep you need. And they interfere on a molecular basis with memory consolidation, which occurs in sleep. The over-the-counter ones, and so 7 out of 9 studies show the prescription medicines for sleep, the vast majority, there's a few exceptions, increase your risk of dementia. And the over-the-counter ones that have diphenhydramine in it increase your risk of dementia. Not if you take them when you're traveling for a few days, but when you take them nightly. And so I have many patients who are medicating normal sleep simply because they think they're not sleeping well because they have a false idea in their head that I shouldn't be waking up. If you wake up, but you're able to get back to sleep naturally within a few minutes, even 15 minutes, you don't need to medicate that. And in fact, prior to electricity, historians have now documented people did not sleep in 1 8-hour interval. Prior to electricity, people would go to sleep sometime between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. at night. They would sleep from 3 to 4 hours, get up anywhere from 10 to midnight, be up from 2 to 4 hours, go back to sleep around 2, and sleep for another 3 to 4 hours. They had the first sleep bout and the second sleep bout. That's how people slept up until about 105 years ago when electricity became popular, and then people started staying up later and consolidating that. Have you ever read, anybody heard of Ellen White? Did you ever read some of her historical stuff? How many nights was she up in the night writing? Did you think she had a sleep problem? This is how people slept. She would sleep 4 hours, get up, write for 2 to 3 hours, and go back to sleep. That's normal sleep. So I have one patient, maybe 2 now, that's how they sleep. They sleep for 4 hours, they're up for 3 or 4 hours, and they sleep. They don't need to medicate that. The medications will cause more problems. So understanding normal sleep is really important, and people feel better when they're not being inappropriately medicated. Low light level at night. Elderly people who sleep with low light on in their room have higher risk of depression than those who sleep in darkness. How much light is too much that will cause an increasing depression in that group would be 5 lux of light. Now, what is 5 lux of light? In the family room lighting at your home, that's about 50 lux. Street lights are 20 to 50 lux. A full moon, on a bright night of a full moon, that's 0.5 to 1 lux. So about 5 times brighter than a full moon is enough light to interfere with normal sleep and contribute to depression in the elderly folks. And then we need to eliminate toxins like alcohol and drug abuse and those types of things. And then what about TMS? Well, this is transcranial magnetic stimulation. We have this in my office. This is an electromagnet, the strength of an MRI magnet, 2 Tesla. And the person is awake and alert, and there's no IVs and there's no medications. And you put it on the part of the brain that corresponds with the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and magnetic pulses will go right across the cranium into that part of the brain and will cause depolarization of that part of the brain to fire. And during a treatment course of 37 minutes, you will do that 3,000 pulses, and they will fire those neurons 3,000 times. And the way the brain is designed, and that's showing the activity in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex during TMS treatment, and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is connected to your anterior cingulate cortex. So guess what? You're not only activating the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is underactive in depression, you're activating the anterior cingulate cortex, which is underactive in depression. And if you remember how the brain's wired, that's wired into the amygdala, sending an inhibitory tone down, calming the amygdala. So TMS actually puts the neural circuits and drives the neural circuits back in their non-depressed state, and also turns on brain-derived neurotrophic factors, so you get the neurotrophins being produced again. And then spiritual interventions. We talked about Newberg's study this morning about the meditating 12 minutes a day on a God of love within 30 days causing growth in the anterior cingulate cortex and calming the amygdala. And so a God construct of love is going to have an antidepressant benefit. A God construct of fear and dread and terror is going to have a pro-depressive effect. So the belief systems we hold have an impact on our overall well-being and health as well. And then altruism, adults who volunteer after accounting for the various baseline variables have less depression than those who don't volunteer. Because volunteerism activates anterior cingulate cortex and brings a sense of reward and accomplishment. So how healthy spirituality slows the aging? Because a healthy spirituality activates prefrontal cortex and anterior cingulate cortex, calms amygdala, and reduces the inflammatory cascade. Altruistic activities result in better physical health as well as mental health. And then people who have healthy spirituality tend to worry less because they tend to trust God more with the things they can't control. And many of my patients who worry, if you actually dissect their worries, almost all of their worries are about things they have no control over. A great many of them are future things that may never even happen. And so learning how to trust God with how things turn out. You know, it says in the Bible, the just, which means the right or the righteous, those who are right with God or the just, live by, anybody know? By faith. And so what that means, this is how I understand it, means the righteous or the just do in governance of themselves, they choose in governance of themselves to do the right or just thing. And then they trust God with how it turns out. How it turns out, it's not up to them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego on the plain of Dura, they had a decision to make in governance of self. Do we bow or do we not bow? That's my choice. That's their choice. How it turned out after that was not their choice. The just do what's right and trust God with the outcome. But I'm not sure that I would have had the faith of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I would have been sitting there, and maybe one of you could have been next to me, and we'd have looked at each other and go, bowing to this idol, we can't do that, it's out. But fiery furnaces, not on the agenda. I know, when the music plays, we'll tie our shoe. Man looks on the outward appearance, God looks on the heart. He knows that in my heart I'm not bowing. I can't help but these other people think I'm bowing. That's not up to me. I'm simply tying my shoe. This is how we work, right? Because I'm going to control the outcome. I don't trust God with my life. I don't trust him with how it turns out. I've got to be in control. I'm afraid. And if I'd have done that, I'm sure God would have been gracious to me, the little child that I am. And I wouldn't have gotten in the furnace. And Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't have met Jesus in the furnace either. Because they trusted God with the outcome, he was able to use them. Do you ever think God doesn't do more on earth because he doesn't have enough people willing to trust him with the outcome? The just do what's right in governance of self and trust God with how it turns out. Healthier lifestyle, people who have healthy spirituality take better care of the spirit temple, so they have less inflammation because of their lifestyle. And they tend to have healthier relationships because they don't hold grudges. They forgive those who do them wrong, and they are less likely to actually exploit or take advantage, so they have less guilt to deal with because they're going to be living in harmony with God's design, so their relationships are less stressful. So in summary, depression is a debilitating illness with damage to brain and body. Antidepressants alone are often inadequate, but sometimes they're quite life-saving. There's various non-drug treatments available for treating depression, and the treatment should be individualized, meaning you should identify the contributing factors in each person's life and hit as many of those as you can to put them in harmony with what's most healthy.